Support for this News from Lake Wobegon podcast comes from the Sleep Number bed by Select Comfort, the bed that lets you adjust the mattress firmness to your preference, your sleep number.
Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown, out there on the edge of the prairie. It's been very, very hot out there, and the gardens have been growing at tremendous speed, and the air conditioners have been turned on. In our town, we limit their use to the elderly and the infirm, but nonetheless, those people still argue over what the temperature should be on the thermostat. The Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church, they've been concerned about low attendance on Sunday mornings. They had about 20 people there this last Sunday, setting new low records. When you have only 20 people in that sanctuary, the sermon does start to seem rather personal. Makes people uneasy, and even fewer people show up. But there was a great crowd for the great 4th of July carnival, and corn dogs served down there by the lake, and the big Ferris wheel was there, and the merry-go-round, and those wonderful rides that teenagers are strapped into, that hurl them around at terrific centrifugal force and to bright lights flashing and music blaring and young people screaming. It's a wonderful thing to go see if you're not actually on one yourself. My little girl loves this. She loves to swing high. This is a new thing with her. She loves to go high so that her head goes up into the branches of an apple tree. It's a great thrill for her. I stand at her foot and I push on her feet. She stiffens her legs and I keep pushing her and she goes higher and higher. And she comes to a point where at the very top of the swing, she laughs out loud. And then on the back swing, I see a look of terror on her face. And I push on the soles of her feet and she goes high up into the tree and laughs again. That point where joy and terror meet, where religion begins. I sometimes hear children weeping in the night and wake up and realize that I was dreaming and that I was a counselor again at Camp Scotty on Lake Winnississibigosh up in northern Minnesota. And I was in a tent on a wilderness trip. I had 9 little 13-year-old boys with me, and one of them was weeping that he heard something outside the tent. And I told him that everything was all right, to go to sleep, and we would be all right. I was learning to lie to children. Even then, I said, "Go back to sleep. It's okay." I don't know how I wound up at that camp. I needed a job, I guess. That was it. I was a junior in the University of Minnesota. I was an English major. I was a poet. I wasn't interested in children. I was interested in myself, of course. I wrote poems. They were all about winter, all of my poems. I never wrote summer poems. My life is a shadow on a snowbank, the wings of a great snowy owl, the reflection of frozen tears of my grandmother, who was turned into a spruce tree with one outstretched bough to say, "There, I went that way." I needed a job, and nobody was willing to pay me for my poetry, and so I had a friend who was an English major whose name was Pruitt, and he said, "Go down there and apply for a job as a counselor. Tell them you are an Eagle Scout and that you have your Red Cross life-saving certificate." So I went down to the Camp Scotty office. I couldn't lie that much, but I told them I had been in Boy Scouts, which was true, and that I had studied life-saving, which was sort of true if you count reading magazine articles in Boy's Life. And Mr. Bulger, who was the camp director, gave me a little talk about having this opportunity to mold lives. And now here I was in a tent with this kid weeping about something outside. And I told him everything would be all right. Go lie down, close your eyes, go to sleep. But I could hear something out there. There was something sort of grunting, and I heard the whisper of brush and the crackle of twigs, and then I realized it was the other counselor, Roger. And he wasn't trying to scare us. I could smell the smoke. He was out there smoking dope. He was out under a tree. I went outside, and he was taking great deep drags on this cigarette he had rolled himself. And he said, "Oh, man, that's so great. Oh, you're going to love this. I can't believe this story." I said, "Roger, we have 18 boys that we're responsible." He didn't care. He had cut his ties to earth. He was gone. Roger was obsessed with smoking dope. It was all he thought about all day, was when he would get a chance to take the next toke. He was a scrawny guy with blonde hair, and he wore glasses that were about 3/4 inch thick and this great long-billed cap. He always walked around slumped over and looking down at the ground, because he told us he couldn't look up, because if his glasses caught even a ray of sunlight, we would see smoke coming out of the top of his head. So you'd be going along some wilderness trail, and you've got 18, 13-year-old boys who are running all over in the woods. You can't keep track of them all. You know there's poison ivy in there, and you're looking around. Where's Roger? Well, you know where he is. He's back that way. So you tell the kids, "I want you to sit down. Everybody sit down in a circle. I'll be right back. Don't move until I come back." And you walk down the trail, and you can see the smoke coming from some big trees, from behind some big rock. And it was Roger back there. "Oh, man, this is such great stuff. I just can't believe it. That was the trip where the little boy who had been constipated for 5 days because he just couldn't bring himself to go out in the woods and drop his drawers and hold onto a tree and squat and crap. He couldn't do that. Finally, after 5 days, he had an emergency and he dashed off into the woods and he crapped in the woods and he was too embarrassed to come back to camp for paper. And so he used leaves, and he used the wrong leaves, yes. Of all of the leaves that God provided in the forest, this one leaf was the one God did not intend to be used for that. The boy came wandering back to camp, and of course it was the fat kid. Of course you know it was the fat kid. He wandered into camp. He was weeping. Oh, the other kids were so cruel to him. I took him into a tent. I laid him down on a sleeping bag. I gave him some water to drink. I told the other kids to go off in a tent and shut up, or I will kill you. It took me a long time to convince this little boy that he absolutely had to come down to the lake with me and wash himself off with this special soap that I had and apply this ointment. And finally, I got him to do it. I almost wept to look at him. He was so sorrowful. He was so full of grief. My troubles were nothing compared to this boy's troubles. I took him down to the water and I gave him the soap and I averted my eyes as he took off his pants and he washed himself. And then I handed him the lotion. I took a glance. Boy, he was red. Oh, right down the crack. I never saw it. Anybody so red as that. I told him that he could rest in the tent, that if he didn't feel like traveling tomorrow, we would wait for him. We would not leave him behind. I told him things that I think I saw John Wayne tell some wounded trooper in a cavalry movie somewhere, Joel McRae or somebody. Except that guy hadn't been shot in the butt like my guy had been shot in the butt. And then we got into our canoes and we had to canoe back to Lake Winnississibigosh. And Roger was inert matter. He was... I had heard him the night before. He was leading the boys around the campfire. He was trying to get people to sing A Whiter Shade of Pale. That was not a real counselor I had here. This boy had departed. There we canoed across this lake. I remember this as one of the most terrifying moments of my life. We canoed. There were six canoes across the lake, and the sky turned black and lightning all around us. And I said, "Keep on, boys, canoe that way." But I couldn't help but think of all those parents who had entrusted their precious children to idiots, to absolute gibbering idiots. And then we finally made our way back to camp. Scotty and Mr. Bulger and Mrs. Bulger were there to welcome us back. They ran the camp, the two of them. Mr. Bulger kind of looked like Teddy Roosevelt, great big toothy grin and wearing fresh creased shorts and a lanyard with a whistle around. I never saw him leave camp, but he sort of liked the idea of nature, I think. His wife did all the cooking and the cleaning, and Mr. Bulger gave the inspirational talks and led the chapel. They divided up the work, a lot like a lot of marriages. So he would lead us in chapel around the fire at night and talk about Wilbur Scott, for whom the camp had been named the great aviator, and talk about how surely the pine pointing up towards the sky should turn our minds toward the spirit of love that surrounds us here in this beautiful world, and so forth, while Mrs. Bulger was in the kitchen chain-smoking and making turkey flop and drinking a little cognac out of a coffee cup, and cursing him with every breath, cursing him every day, although when he almost died that day, I never saw anyone so grief-stricken as she was for her husband. Wilbur Scott, the camp was named after, Camp Winnississibigosh, the great aviator from Minnesota who was the first man to fly the length of the Mississippi nonstop, which was no great feat in 1948. And perhaps he was the first to do it because nobody else had thought of it. But he started in New Orleans and he flew up along the river. Navigation, no problem, really. To amuse himself, he shot at mergansers and geese from the cockpit with a shotgun, flying his old Curtiss biplane north over St. Louis and Dubuque and over the Twin Cities, and finally came in towards Bemidji and Itasca, the headwaters of the Mississippi. And there, three sheets to the wind, celebrating his triumphant flight even before he landed, he shot at a merganser and shot the flaps right off his plane. Plane took him right straight down into Lake Itasca, where he died a hero's death. The camp was named for him, and his ashes were spread in the fire pit there at Camp Scotty. We celebrated his birthday every 4th of July, and I remember that 4th of July when Pruitt, my friend, told Mr. Bulger, "Wouldn't it be great to celebrate Wilbur Scott's birthday with a flight of our own?" Pruitt had rigged up a kite with a little trapeze under it. It was the first parasail I'd ever seen. And he told Mr. Bulger, "Wouldn't it be great if you made the first flight?" He explained how it worked. You just held on to the trapeze and the boat pulled the tow rope and you flew up in the air as the boat circled around the lake. Well, the campers were all listening to this, of course. The campers who had heard Mr. Bulger's chapel talks on how we should dare to do the difficult thing. So he couldn't really say no, could he? Though he looked terrified as he sat at the end of the dock and they held the kite up over him as he took hold of the trapeze and the tow rope was there and Pruitt at the controls of the boat grinned back at him, a cruel grin, and then motored slowly out until the tow rope was taut and then hit the gas. And he flew off the dock, and he skied on his skis for a little ways, and then he fell in the water but did not let go of the rope. And the water tore his swim trunks from his body, and then finally the kite took off and lifted him up in the air, his shorts down around his ankles, towed him around several times. We'd never seen this before in our lives. A naked man under a kite flying. It was like Icarus. Pruitt was watching him. Pruitt was watching him so closely that he didn't see the diving dock coming up. And he ran the boat right straight into it, and the kite just flew on out. Just flew on out over shore, over our heads. Over our heads. Mr. Bulger tried to run when he touched ground, but of course, he had the shorts around his ankles. He came down in the raspberry bushes. He was taken to the hospital. Mrs. Bulger went with him, weeping. And so it fell to me to make the turkey flop for supper and to lead chapel, which I had never done before. But I told the boys over the campfire, I said, we must live this life one day at a time, boys. We're not guaranteed tomorrow. Life is fragile. And before we think about tomorrow, we must give thanks for today and think of one wonderful thing that we enjoyed today and thank God for it. And we all thought of the same thing and we all thanked God for it, whether we should have or not. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, all the children are above average.